This is a Pinball News production.
All right, thank you. So my name is Brian Madden. I'm going to sort of moderate this conversation today. And there's five of us up here. I figure let's just first talk about what we want to share in the next hour or so in our roles. And, of course, we want to answer your questions. So going right down the row, let's start with, on the end, Aaron, just who you are and what you're doing here.
So, yeah, like Mike said, we've developed this hardware to really... Oh, is that better there? All right. So, you know, the idea of getting into making games was something that, you know, we thought there was a lot of room to innovate for. So being able to work with, you know, Dave and myself to develop a platform to get new people making pinball is really what got us into this. And so for me personally, it was to have a new challenge. You know, I've done software for a long time, and the idea of creating a hardware interface to create a pinball platform to make games was a good mental challenge. So for me, getting into this, you know, later in my career, it was a great chance to work with a lot of really smart people to make some really cool stuff. So I'm really in here as a chance to you know, get more people making pinball, and for myself to enrich my own life and make and create something great. So I don't know, I'm just kind of rambling.
Yeah, okay. So Brian Cox.
There you go. All right, thank you. Yeah, so my name is Brian Cox. I'm a custom pinball designer outside of my normal job. And this is game number four for me, and I think that what really brought me to the FAST and the Mission Pinball framework is that I really wanted this game to sort of take it to the next level, and definitely the hardware and the firmware that these guys are working on is what allowed me to do that. And so hopefully we'll take it even higher next
year. Yeah, and we'll keep that conversation going. Dave Beecher?
Yes, hi, I'm Dave Beecher. I'm the hardware designer for the Hardware for FAST, and my day job is actually creating hardware for, you know, clients and all of that. But it's always been a huge pinball enthusiast, have, you know, collected pinball machines for years, and I always thought I had a fun day job until I started working with the pinball with Aaron, and man, now my other job kind of sucks, so glad to be here.
Hi, my name is Gabe Knuth, and I'm one of the co-creators of the Mission Pinball Framework, which is a free open source platform for making the custom rules that uses the hardware that these guys make. We started off trying to make a custom machine, and then we got wrapped up writing code and realized that everybody else doing a custom machine has to write the same code over and over and over again. And so we have an IT background, and we decided to use that sort of desire to standardize things and make things repeatable and easy to do, also work with pinball. So we've worked on this Mission Pinball Framework platform to make it easier for people to create games, spend more time designing a game and less time coding it.
And I'm Brian Madden, also working on a Mission Pinball Framework, so everything that he said is also from me. But let me translate real fast, okay? So hardware guy, these two guys, they make circuit boards. You put them in the pinball machines, and you can talk to the pinball machines with modern computer, either Linux or Mac or Windows. You can put it in new pinball machines or old pinball machines. So that's this guy and this guy. This guy and me do the software. And it's the software that talks to the hardware that lets you do your pinball machine. The software, that's what's called Mission Pinball. It's free. It's open source. And this guy used their hardware and our software to make that. So that's kind of how this breaks down. And what we want to talk about is how you can do the same thing. Because Aaron and Dave making hardware, we talk about they want to do all the boring stuff. They want to figure out all the circuit timings and switch matrix polings and how to PWM and LED to make it light up and how you plug it together and tell you where to hook up your ground wires. They do all that. Gabe and me with the pinball software do all the boring stuff. We figure out how to know where the ball is and how to do ball save and multi-ball and lock a ball and unlock a ball and make this display play when this event happens and add these scorings and these points and these kinds of things. So that people like Brian Cox, who's an artist, can take his vision of how he wants the pinball machine to work and actually bring it to life. Now, Brian Cox, you have a 12 o'clock hard stop with taxi to go back to the airport. I want to start with you talking a little bit about Tattoo Mystique. This is your fourth pinball machine. My name is Brian Madden. I came to Expo a few years ago. true story, and texted photos to my girlfriend of your apron that says Pinball by Brian. And I'm like, there's someone else named Brian who does pinball. This is amazing. And that was not this machine. This is your fourth machine.
That's right. And what was the question?
So talk about, so this Tattoo Mystique, talk real quick about this machine. This is not a re-theme. It's a custom machine from scratch.
That's right. And yeah, so my whole philosophy is pinball as art. And that's not just, it's sort of a new paradigm. It's not just, you know, drawing the art on the play field. It is actually controlling the game rules. It's doing your own play field layout. It's the cabinet. It's the video, the sound, everything. So the pinball machine, if as a pinball artist, the pinball machine is now sort of a unified, interactive performance art piece. And the people today that build pinball machines are sort of the new brand of pinball artist. So, and of course, and the point of all this is that we're at a point where the technology is such that anyone who has a passion for pinball can actually build the dream game that they've always wanted since they were a kid. They can actually do that today. So as Brian, his question, so a little bit about the Tattoo Mystique pinball machine. So it is a custom play field. But it's designed in the way that the old Bally Williams games from the 80s, late 70s, early 80s. So it has a very vintage look to it. So it's a street-level game. It's got the kind of old-school cabinet. The one thing I've added, an important feature, you know, provided by the MPF, is the DMD. Which I think sort of is, that's part of what I was saying, but that it takes it to the next level. Because with the Mission Pinball framework, you can actually design slides and videos and other elements for your video display, and it's all sort of presented in a very easy, seamless, I wouldn't say plug and play, but nearly plug and play way to do your pinball shows and switching modes and things like that.
I want to come back to this pinball as art thing, because a lot of us, when we hear pinball art, we think of the drawings. We think of the cabinet art, the playfield art, the back glass art. But really, the pinball machine in general is an art form. The entire package is art. You know, the gameplay is as much a part of the art. The theme, the cabinet, the woodworking, the electronics, the wiring, the concepts, where it is an entire, you know, the entire machine is something built by a
right.
creative person. This is not, the art is not just the stenciling the cabinets and painting the playfields.
Right, and the difference today is that the technology has come to a point where as an individual, you don't have to be an expert in every aspect of game design in order to sort of create your own vision. So I think this allows, and we've seen this in the vendor hall, there's like at least 10 different custom games. And all of them are unique. All of them are sort of the exact vision that the individual was trying to execute. And even if we don't agree with their theme or whatever, it is the exact theme that they wanted and the exact layout that they wanted and the exact art package and everything else and game rules. Game rules are also a big part of that. That is a big part of the overall sort of interactive design of the game, right? So the technology is here today that anyone can essentially create or become a pinball artist without having to become an expert in the software or becoming an expert in having to build the hardware.
And to that end, Aaron Davis, you have talked about how what you guys want to do at Fast Pinball is do the boring stuff.
Right.
Behind the scenes, because you know, from an electrical engineering standpoint, there's a lot that goes on inside a pinball machine.
Oh yeah,
and one of your goals is to make it so that sort of, I don't want to sound offensive, like normal humans, not you two guys,
right.
but normal humans can build pinball machines.
Oh yeah, Well, I think when we first showed off that we were making hardware, the groups that were most interested right off the bat were artists and programmers who weren't like pinball programmers. They're used to working with an API or something like that. They know how to create a game experience, whether it's on like iOS apps or console games. But the idea of being able to use a pinball game where they can work their experience into an interface they've never used before is enticing and it's exciting. And then the artists who come to the game, or come to these shows to see all of the pinball artwork that's in all these games, they love the nostalgia and the image of pinball. Well, they can do the artwork, but never thought that they could actually drive a game of their own. So, like it's been said that you can get a game going and have a good kind of working knowledge of a lot of different parts, but getting a few people together to collaborate on a game really gives you the chance to kind of focus on what you're good at, but not feel like not having a huge software background or hardware background keeps you from getting started. And I think that making it accessible is a big deal. And I mean, it's kind of maybe sort of where the Fast name came from, is like nobody's drawn to pinball because they want to work on electronics or they want to wire things up or work on software. They want to create an experience that other people can share. They can get an idea out of their head, get it down onto a play field, and let other people play it. And that's the exciting part. I mean, like being at these shows here and seeing the custom games, people come up to the booth and they're just like, what is this? Where is this? I've never seen this before. And even when the Tattoo Mystique game first appeared, so the first game that's running the Fast hardware and the Mission Pinball framework that made a public appearance was at our June show up in Seattle. And we were watching people from, as we were kind of standing back, and they were coming up going, how did I miss this game? Like thinking it was of the era. And Brian's design was meant to capture that, that aesthetic of that era, but modernize it in kind of a fun way. So it's, working on hardware and software and creating a platform to make things with, seeing things actually made from what you've worked on is so exciting. And it's inspiring for other people as well. And I think that's really what's so fun about bringing these out to the shows and showing people who've never seen it before.
There's an interesting parallel on the software side also. Lots of people said, I want to make my own pinball machine. That would be cool. No one says, I want to spend a week till 3 a.m., 7 days in a row, figuring out why the trough is ejecting a second ball on a certain multi-ball situations. Except for Gabe and me.
So in our role, I focus more on hardware, and he focuses on software. So we have epic battles about, I swear this is a hardware problem. And he goes, no, I see it there. I swear it's a software problem. He says, no, I see it in the logs. It's a hardware problem. I'm like, I promise you, this diverter is not open. I will show you this picture. It's not open.
But, in the Fast Pinball booth over there on the expo hall, there's 7 machines in various states of completion that are running some form of Fast hardware and Mission Pinball framework. And there's the guy, Mark in City, who did The Nightmare Before Christmas. And he's got a bunch of folks playing it. And at one point, the ball stopped coming out of the trough. And I gave him a USB stick. I said, give me the logs. And so he's showing people that are playing the game. And it was only in some scenarios where the ball did not eject out of the trough. He gave him the USB stick. He restarted the game, and people continued playing it. And I went and looked and found it, fixed the bug, give him the USB stick. There you go. And so there's the whole team behind. We've seen with other folks in the booth, they have the same thing from the wiring standpoint, because one guy was having issues with the way his wiring was working, and Dave Beecher takes a look at that and says, here's what you got to do.
Get rid of a lot of wire. He had kind of like wired kind of the more traditional way of a pinball, putting the hardware elsewhere. Almost all of the drivers were down in the cabinet and all that, and one of the things we try to do is, keep this really simple. Try to put the switches and the coils really close to the hardware so you don't have all these wire runs that you have to try to find when something goes bad. So anyway, he had spent a lot of time doing that, spent a lot of time undoing it, but I think in the end he's going to be really happy because now when he opens it up, there won't be this whole tail of wire, going down to the bottom of his cabinet. So anyway.
I was like, you have a whole setup of wire for your next game.
Yes,
like,
yeah, there you go.
For now and there,
And that's one of the things we sort of illustrate is that, Dave and Aaron work on the hardware to provide guidance and support and best practices for hardware. Gabe and I write the software to provide guidance and best practices and help you with that. And Brian has been one who has been, an early adopter of both the hardware and the software and been in our forums helping other people when they're saying, I want to do this. And Brian says, well, I did this 6 months ago and here's what I did. But Brian Cox, I'm going to go back to you. There's something you talk about in the design process about working backwards from your idea. You have a vision, not even necessarily for a full game, but I want the game to do this. and then you work backwards. I wonder if you can talk about your process a little bit with that, and then how you tie that back to the specific hardware and software.
Right, right. And I think and one of the points I want to make is that I think that there is this sort of new paradigm of the pinball artists, and what that really means is that sort of anybody at this show who's enthusiastic about pinball and wants to create their own pinball machine can become a pinball artist. But part of that is that each person is going to have their own sort of independent vision of what they want to do. There is no really sort of canned answer for everything that they want to do. But the point is that as a pinball artist, you're going to create your own sort of vision of what the pinball machine should be and what the game should be and what the rules should be. And so to Brian Madden's point, as you're designing something, you know what the layout looks like, and you're starting to work out your rules. And you know, maybe the documentation for the Mission Pinball Framework is huge. I mean, there's
that point. It's huge. Like,
yeah, it is huge. They printed it out just to show how huge it is. So the documentation is there, but you don't have to read it. That's the good part. You do not have
Wait,
to read the documentation.
Why did I work so hard okay. on it?
But here, okay, but here's the point. So let's say you have, so you're the artist and you're creating your game, and let's say you have some sort of drop target assembly. You want to say, I want to hit this target 5 times, and then this target 3 times, and then this target 1 time, and then that releases a ball, and then I go into a different mode. And now I want to work backwards. Okay, now how do I do that, right? So it's not like you had to have read the entire manual there, and then you'll know what to do. What happens is you figure out what it is that you want to do, and then you go backwards and you say, okay, well, let me find if that's in there. And then you do your little search, and sure enough, there's a mode for that, or there's a configuration for that. And you basically type in your settings. You're like, okay, I want to hit this one 5. I put a 5 here and a 3 here and a 1 there, and I trigger an event, and then my mode starts. And that's pretty much the way that this is supposed to work. You know, you're not supposed to be a computer science major in order to get your game running, but at the same time, you can sort of come up and invent, you know, very complicated game rules that only you would ever want to put in your game, and there's a way to execute that.
Aaron, I wonder if you can talk a little bit about the community that's building up around sort of the custom build space. Because what we see in 2015, you know, there's a resurgence of the whole sort of maker movement, as right. they call it. And we're seeing, you know, hack spaces, maker spaces opening up. Pinball, of course, everyone knows is resurging, and a lot of that is tied to the fact that it's a physical thing and it's more satisfying than, you know, like playing virtual pinball or right. building something real. Certainly we've seen communities pop up around the Fast Pinball group. You know, there's a bunch of folks here in your booth. There's an online Slack community.
Right.
But you talk about the importance of a community to build these games together versus, you know, shipping boards to people.
Well, I think what's interesting with that is, like, you know, with, like, we've got a users group where it's all the owners of hardware. So everybody in the group has Fast hardware. And so everyone is going through their different experiences, getting their games up and running, or trying to invent new ideas and things. And really quickly, it's become sort of a brotherhood of different people solving different problems. And so, like, you know, everybody's got different skills, and it's sometimes you've been working on your game for a really long time, and it's just trudging along and trying to get everything just right. But the chance to help somebody else on their project is kind of fun. You can hop in, do something you're good at, inspire them to keep going, and hop back out. And we've seen that kind of stuff already happening amongst all the games everybody's developing internally here, or with the group that you see at the booth. And I think that it creates that kind of camaraderie, and I just kind of describe it as, like, you know, a bunch of rock bands on tour together. You know, it's like we're all going out there to put on a good show and a good experience, but we're also trying to, you know, do the best experience we can. So you're kind of one-upping each other in a kind of a cool, you know, an appropriate, healthy way. But I think that the inspiration for, you know, accomplishing this frustrating task or something is, for a lot of us, like, to come and share what we did. Like, look, what I finally got it working. Or, you know, I'm frustrated with this. Can somebody help me? And then get that feedback and bring that to light. And then all of a sudden, like, it's not just Dave and I, like, giving feedback on things. Like, we may not chime in to the group before somebody else jumps in and solves a problem for them, you know? So I think that it's important to have that kind of feedback. And I think a lot of the assumption is that everybody loves to do things, you know, in secret and private and off someplace where no one else sees what they're working on. But you know, sometimes you can build yourself into a corner or waste a lot of time on something that's taken away from the momentum of the project. And so, like Brian was saying, like having access to tools and resources, you know, in this day and age that we've never had before. I mean, just to be able to walk in a place and take your design and CNC cut a play field or get some laser cut plastics or something like that, you can really quickly make, you know, the game that you spend a lot of time writing code on stuff look really professional really quick.
And it, think and about how much easier that is now than it was 5 or 6 or 7 years ago. I mean, it's to retheme a game back then was a really big deal. And nowadays we have all this modern hardware that we can drop into a machine that exists and use its existing driver boards if we want to just retheme something. Or we can build our own custom one from scratch, and we can build our own playfield toys with 3D printers. Mm-hmm. We have so many more tools available to us than we've ever had before.
Yeah. I agree, and it's, you know, for a lot of people too, there's, you may go into a game and you know how to do a bunch of something, but there's the few things you didn't know, you know, and it's a reason to learn. You know, a lot of people have never worked with electronics and stuff before and have never thought about wiring something up, and now they've got a challenge in front of them in a box. You know, it's a contained problem to solve, and you know, it's always great to find inspiration to learn something new and a new skill. And I think that that's, you know, pinball's been a great experience for that. It's a motivation to learn new things.
But so if you don't know how to wire something up, now you have to learn that. Yeah. And but you also, pinball's so complex, right? Now you also have to learn physics and mechanics and programming and all of these other things. And that's why today is so much better than it was in the past, just because there's so many of these different tools available to you that makes every single one of those things easier. So you can focus on the parts you do best and then leave some of the other stuff to the other people, like the hardware guys, the software guys, and so on.
Well, and also just the accessibility of, you know, YouTube and this kind of thing. Like, I'm going to use air quotes. I knew how to solder since I was a kid. I learned how to solder from YouTube.
You solder with flux. Yeah,
there you go. So, yeah, my mom did stained glass, so I knew how to, right? And but I learned how to solder from YouTube. When you can see it, it's the same thing. So the play field we were looking at yesterday, rewiring, we did a video of that and posted it to YouTube of Dave explaining, well, here's what I don't like about this. Here's how I would move it. I'd move the wires over here, over there, over there. And now that's just available, and that just exists in the world, which is kind of great. Yeah. I want to take an opportunity to keep this open for questions. If anyone has any questions or anything you'd like to add, please throw it out. You can say it to me, and I'll repeat it into the microphone. So go ahead, sir.
Well, easy one. So I saw Ryan's presentation at Past Expo, and this card says that Tattoo Mystique is game number 3, so I guess he changed his mind about the order of three.
That's a good question.
Sorry, the question is for Brian Cox, so you couldn't hear it. A couple of things. So the card says this is game number 3, but was it game number 3, number 4? Did you change your mind in there? And I'm going to ask a follow-up question also. Go answer that first. So, yeah.
Okay.
What games have you built in what order?
Okay, so as I mentioned, I have 4 games that I've built so far. I actually have other games in process, and so... obviously, creating a pinball machine takes a long time, right? So each game, I think, from start to finish, is probably like a 2-year process. But I try to at least release or crank out one about once a year, which means that I usually have at least 2 in process. The Tattoo Mystique one is sort of unique because I did a majority of the artwork, the back glass, the plastics. But the playfield, I wanted this sort of Sailor Jerry kind of look to the playfield. So I actually commissioned an artist to hand paint directly on the playfield, and she has sort of a style that matches what I was looking for. But the upshot of it, to answer your question, is that I usually have 2 machines in process, and so while I was having her work on this playfield, so basically I created the playfield, put the inserts in. Got it finished, handed it off to the artist, and during that time, I was actually working on machine number 4, doing the cabinet, the play field, but not the artwork. So I was focusing on the hardware aspects of it. So last year, I brought 3 machines. It was Jupiter Crush, Retro Spa, and the Whitewood was Misadventure. So Misadventure is game number 4, but it was actually finished as a Whitewood prior to Tattoo Mystique being finished. So technically, and I had already made the card for number 4, so I can't start renumbering after the card's already made. But so the 3 games I brought last year were actually number 1, number 2, and number 4. And then number three, you know, the artist finished up early.
They had project codes that were higher.
Yeah.
This is going to be great trivia fodder for Pinside in the future, if someone to drop these little bombs on people about their knowledge.
And if you're collecting the cards, you need to keep track of all this. So the point is, I guess, that if you're going to be doing a lot of this, then, yeah, you're going to have multiple games in process. If you're just sort of the weekend pinball guy, you might have the same game. You might be working on it for 5 years or so. So that's the story behind the number three. I think I saw a question back there.
Yes, sir.
I spoke as an artist, and I heard words like vision and experience, and I want to ask you just a couple of points. As an artist, you start out with a vision, and I like to know what your vision is and how it differs from different games. And then experience, what do you want to be when I play that game, walk away with? When everyone speaks of art, I always think of Monet and Van Gogh, and Billy Joel. I just want to throw this out. Is this an experience you're embodying? Billy Joel sings about his former girlfriends and stuff like that. Is this sort of one of your relationships embodied in a game?
So let me paraphrase the question for those listening to the internet stream. Brian Cox, you talked about an artist, and you've got both the vision you think about the experience. So the vision is your vision for the machine, and the experience is about what you want the players and the people viewing the art, what you want their experience to be. And the question is about how does vision experience play into your thing? Is it based on personal, hardships in your past lives? Is it based on that? Where does that come from, and how does vision and experience tie into what you do as an artist?
Okay, so it's not as deep as Billy Joel. Let me just put that out there. So that's a very good question. And so in part of my philosophy, art, we think of sort of aesthetic as being sort of the measure of art. But the definition of aesthetic is is content put into a structure to create meaning, right? So the meaning is, if there's no meaning, there's no aesthetic, and if you don't understand the meaning, then there's no aesthetic, and then that is sort of the quality of art, right? So you're right. You do have to it has to have some kind of meaning. You have to understand what's the song about, what's the artwork about, what's the painting about, right? With my games, I have a couple of things I try to do with each game. What I want to do first and foremost is I want to keep people interested in the game, which is very hard to do in an old school game, because there's so many video games that have so many levels, and even modern games have ramps and modes and things. So one of the challenges is, how do you keep the game sort of fresh and interesting in an old school kind of street level format? So that's my first challenge, is keeping the game interesting. The second thing is I like to add an element of magic, kind of like a hook, the way a song has a hook. You add some sort of element of magic to the game that's like a hook that people say, wow, how do they do that? What is that? And then there's also an element of game theory I like to add. I want people to approach the game, and maybe they play the game 50 times, and they, after the 50th time, maybe they start to get it a little bit, and then they change their strategy, and they'd say, oh, okay, I'm understanding that there's some risk and some reward here, and now my next 50 games, I'm going to play it a different way. And then after 100 games, maybe say, oh, there's this other thing, and I change my strategy again. And so that sort of helps keeps the gameplay fresh, and you end up playing over and over again, and every time you find something new.
It's kind of like the old single player Gottliebs, that have multiple ways of doing and multiple strategies. The card that we passed out before is Brian Cox's card talking about Tattoo Mystique. On the back, he talks about there's two different colored balls in here. It's a single ball game, but there's two different colored balls.
And hopefully you get to see this when you play it. There's actually two different colored balls. The ball changes color mid game if you make the right shot, but you're gonna wonder how and why did that happen? And it's gonna take playing the game a while to figure that out. But so back to the point, to your question. What is the aesthetic of this game? So I see that the aesthetic is in understanding the game with a pinball machine. If you understand the game, you're getting a high score. That's essentially the bottom line. If you understand the game, you're getting the high score. And so with this game, what I've set up is that if you sort of read the machine and you understand the machine, then you're getting the high score. But it takes a long time. It takes studying and play. But that's part of the enjoyment of the pinball machine is that you don't just walk up to it and get the high score. With this game, you actually have to play it. You know, maybe for weeks before you really get it.
At the Pacific show, I had you showing me this game, explaining to me, pointing out little things about it, and then I actually, to be honest, I couldn't wait for you to leave. Because this thing, at every turn, there's something in this game that's unique. There's UV lighting that makes something change color. There's how I wanted to figure out how the ball worked and, like, you know, practically take your glass off without you being there. You know, you've added an element of mystery to this game where you just know that the more you play it, the more you're going to find out about it. And that's why I think this game is really brilliant. And I think the work that you put into it, I think, shows very much. Question.
Quick question, Brian. We know it's a four game, so this could be like a breakdown game. You may have covered this. How long did it take to do number one, number two, number three, number four?
Yeah.
The question was, how long did it take to make each one of your games?
Sorry. Thank you. The audience probably didn't hear that. Okay. So yeah, how long did it take to create each game? So I have four games. It's usually a 2-year cycle. But I usually have at least one or two games in process. So I have two games in process. So essentially, I've been putting out one game every year. So the first game, like 3 years ago for the Seattle show, was the Jupiter Crush. I was able to get three games the next year, and then this one is the fourth year. And I should say, having two games in process, it sounds like a lot, but the reality is that working on a pinball machine, there's so much stuff where you might do one thing and then you have to wait. You might have to wait a week for a certain part to come in, or you might have to wait for parts to come back from, you know, painting, or you paint something and it has to dry. So having two games going at the same time is actually not so much a waste of time as it is making the most effective use of your time.
Yes, sir.
Yes, I'm looking at the game there, Brian. I see the coin door. Do you make your games to accept money, and is putting the games on location part of the maker experience?
The question is, I see a coin door on your machine. Do you configure your machines to accept money, and is putting your machine on location part of your plans or the maker experience?
I think that should be. I think that everyone should at least set that as a goal for themselves, that they try to make it and design it so that it could be put on location. I've always set my games to free play, but I have actually designed them so that they look like arcade games, and they look like they could accept coins, and I actually have designed them so that they will accept coins. Not this one right now because it doesn't have the coin mechanisms. But I do think that actually is an important part of the sort of custom built experience, that, you know, making it look like it could be on location is a really valuable thing to your aesthetic.
And the build quality too, because if you're making it to be on location, you're making it to get beat up on by guys that have had a couple of beers.
Right.
And so you want to make it robust enough.
Yeah, even if you never plan on putting it on location, you should design in the back of your head, you should think, what happens if I put this on location? And that might change the level of quality that you put into how you do your wiring and such.
The Mission Pinball Framework also does have a credits module. And so this is, again, now if you're thinking about what it takes to accept credits in the machine, you have to be able to set up custom credit tiering and price breaks and know that you can, you know, when you can add more players to the game and when you can accept credits and when you clear credits and the credits have to stay on the game after it reboots and that kind of stuff. Mission Pinball Framework does all that. So if Brian wants to get to the point where he wants to accept money in his machine, besides adding coin mix, he makes a couple lines of config changes, and now he doesn't have to write any of that kind of stuff. We got two questions. You, sir, were first in the front row.
Thank you. Just a question on what is your process for making back glasses?
Question is, what is your process for making your back glasses? I'm going to assume that question is for Brian Cox.
Okay. Very good question. And over the last four games, I've done a different process for each game, but I think I've actually hit on what I think is going to be like the process from here on out. So the glass you're seeing is actually, it's acrylic, and it's reverse printed using a large format printer, a professional print machine, with UV cured inks. But the key there is that they actually are able to print a white ink. And so you can do a combination of sort of translucent colors, opaque colors, and you can have clear areas, as you see there. And in some cases, I actually did, you can do spot colors. And in some cases, I actually did a full color, then the white, and then colors on top behind the white. And so there are certain things that you see from the front, and there are certain things that you see when it's backlit. So there's a lot of things you can do, but I think the process going forward is going to try to use sort of professional print services that can actually print directly on the acrylic or the glass.
How did you prototype that? I mean, you've got a pretty complex back glass there. You know, when we have the flashes turn on and it exposes the skeleton behind that. I mean, were you prototyping that with your own paints on a back glass, or did you have this printed 18 different times?
No, well, I only had it printed once, but I did actually ask the print shop that, and it can get kind of expensive, but not so expensive that it's the equivalent of like silk screen printing. It's way cheaper than silk screen printing, so you actually save yourself a lot of money. But I did have the print shop do things like make the white back like 50% opaque, and or make it 100% opaque. So I actually have like three or four back glasses that have different variations of. Or double print the black. That's a big one. Like if they double print the black, then it really looks saturated. But I think I've actually hit on the right formula. So going forward, I probably will only have like, you know, I'll just run it one time unless I have some new features that I want to try out.
Question from you, sir.
Actually, three. So I've been doing Python for like ever. I love it. I was really excited to see that you guys use Python. So I was really excited about that, but then also I was like, wow, Python like has a problem with concurrency and like how
So yeah, we'll take your questions one at a time. So the first one is, I've been doing the Mission Pinball framework that we do uses Python. He says, I've been using Python for a long time, but Python has you know, issues with concurrency. How do you handle that? We can talk as many dirty details in the back because it's maybe not as many people that care. But I will say this is, number one, our goal with the Mission Pinball framework is you do not have to be a programmer. There's configuration files you can use to set up your hardware. There's a tutorial, step one, step two. It shows you how to download, how to install, how to configure this. Here's your flipper, here's your button, here's your bumper, here's a light. Goes through all that stuff. Even if you don't have a physical machine, you can do it all virtually on your computer. Python is not a fast language compared to other compiled languages. And the way it works is the fast hardware, their board is talking to the actual pinball hardware. And they've got a USB interface on it that you can plug into a computer. So it can be running on your laptop, which is fine for development. Maybe you put it on a BeagleBone or Raspberry Pi if you're doing your final machine. But the idea is that the instant response stuff, I can put a little rule into their board that says when this button is hit, pop this bumper. And then that way, the pop bumpers, the slingshots, the flippers, those things are instantaneous. You know, air quotes again, as close as it is, because it doesn't have to go to the computer and go through Python and all that kind of stuff. And then those rules are always erased and rewritten and reprogrammed even throughout the course of the game as the game is changing logic and that kind of thing. And Mission Pinball Framework handles all that. Let's talk the details later. We've got actually multiple processes. We can make use of multi-core processors. We use different threads for loading assets versus the main game loop, but we can catch that offline. You had multiple questions, but I don't know if you guys want to comment on your hardware. And, you know, it's interesting because...
Yeah, that's all invisible to the artist, let's say.
Yeah. Someone said, made a statement that, you know, all these details, Dave Beecher, you talk about You know, you talked about the details and implementation of how this happens in the wiring and the you know, your protocols that you use and you know, debouncing switches and interference and how all the programming works. And someone said, like, wow, it's almost like people just don't care about what you're saying. And your answer was, yes, that's the point.
Yeah, I mean, the idea was try to make this, you know, as easy as possible. And then when people do run into problems, try to have those answers. Like, for instance, you know, one thing that's popped up recently is slingshots. Like, we've all seen that at some point in time playing a pinball machine where you get into the shotgun mode, you know, just like the switches aren't set quite right and the slingshot just starts going ballistic, right? Won't turn off. And so the thing is, there's all kinds of ways to adjust that. One way is to go in and go bend the switch right, you know, again, right? But the thing is, you know, a lot of these things can be taken care of in software, and it's like everything in the older games was kind of very consistent. Like, it's like there's this millisecond loop going on in the background, and all switches were kind of treated the same. But a slingshot, you know, what do you want a slingshot to do? You really want it, when the ball comes in there, you want it to react very quickly, right? But then when the rubber band's going the opposite way and all that, and then comes back and hit the switches again, you don't really care about that. So by putting things in like individual you know, debounce times for both the switch going down and the switch opening and all of that, it's like all of a sudden we could do that behind the scenes and you don't even know. Just calling it a slingshot, he could put those rules in there that, you know, it's like when that debounce time going up, it's just a lot longer. And it's like you would never know this would ever be a problem. So even if your switches are not set right, you already had a good experience. And that's kind of what we're trying, you know, trying to do with the hardware.
I'm going to say, yeah, so when you configure a slingshot or configure a bumper in the Mission Pinball framework, you say, yo, here's my name, it's a bumper, it's this switch, it's this coil, and you're done. There's a lot of parameters we can tune. The debounce time for the switch to close, the debounce time for the switch to open, the rest time, which is how long it'll wait before it will allow that switch to be triggered again to prevent the machine gunning. And then we, MPF, knows that that's happening, and so if we see the machine gunning, we'll just start changing those settings automatically, even though this is... those coils are fired via one of those automatic hardware rules because we need it to be instant. We'll just keep on sending it new rules until it calms down, until we figure out that point. And we'll log it for you. We can put a credit dot there, you know, to say, hey, we're tuning this for you. But, like, this is 2015, you know? A WPC machine, which we love, those were 2 megahertz processors. I mean, you can't buy anything with only 2 megahertz now, you know? Like, a Band-Aid has more megahertz than that. And so there is so limited to what they can do. And now today's technology, all the boards that connect, when they plug in all their driver boards and switchboards, the whole network, we know that those boards are out there. You know, the WPC connector to the power driver board, 34 pins, that was one way. If that power driver board blew up, you didn't know it. If that FET blew up, you didn't know it. If that board fell off the back, you didn't know it. Now it's a two-way network. The Mission Pinball Framework software, it connects to their board, queries the network, finds out all the boards that are there, finds out all the devices they have, and we know that when we say fire this coil, we know that that coil fired. And if it doesn't fire, they're going to make sure that message is delivered for it to fire. And if they can't, they're going to notify us, and we're going to be able to take action, whether notifying you, a credit dot, workaround, you know, that kind of thing. So the technology is so much more advanced than what, you know, the pinball machines of the 90s were. And then with the fast hardware and the Mission Pinball framework, all that technology happens behind the scenes. You know, we talk about what we're doing. We want to do the boring background stuff, as we said, that makes it so you can just say, hey, this pop bumper is one switch and one coil, and it just works. You never think about it again. Let's go to more. I know you have more questions. If there's anyone else, otherwise we'll come back to you. Let's go in the front row first, sir. Question from the internet chat room for Brian Cox. Would you like to see any of your machines go into production, or are they just one-off projects?
That's a very good question. And that's actually been a sort of a debate issue amongst a lot of the sort of custom builder community. Like, do we try and do like boutique runs, or is this just like a one-off art piece that, you know, will never go to production? So for me personally, I think that None of my previous games are going to go to production, but, you know, that being said, I am working on a couple other games that my goal is not to take them there, but what I do want to do is I want to use, you know, parts, equipment, processes that could eventually take that to production. I'm actually encouraging other custom builders to do the same that if you have a game and at the end of the day, you know, after your 2 years of all this hard work, and then a bunch of people come up to you and say, hey, you know, I want to buy one of these, you may not want to turn them down. You may want to say, you know, sure, I'll build 10 more of these, but you can't do that unless you've sort of planned ahead in terms of your processes and your fabrication techniques and just being able to source parts and stuff.
I'd like to bring that question also to Aaron Davis, because one of the things that you and Dave at Fast Pinball have focused on is not just making the driver boards and the controller boards, but providing for the whole package. And so, for example, you know, power filter boards that have big capacitors on them and recommending switching power supplies that people can use. Backbox interface boards that connect, you know, the playfield to the backbox, to the cabinet. The coin door interface board, so when you open up the door, it's a low power switch on there that cuts off the high power to the fuses, and those various things. And I know you're doing a lot with you know, FCC certification of your boards and that kind of thing, so that, like, there's things I've asked Dave, oh, please make this, and he said, we can't do that because it won't be FCC certified. And I said, yeah, but I can do this myself at home. He's like, yeah, you're not selling it to commercial, you know, locations. So my point is I think what you two are doing at Fast Pinball, it's more than just the boards for, you know, the control the right. machines, but it's, if people wanted to take it into production, the whole package, what they need, that's what you're building.
Right. I mean, it's really paying attention to the process beyond just, like, you know, building a one-off. It's like we want to grow together with a project. If you build something that's great and, you know, somebody wants to buy 10 or 15 games from you, these boards are designed to go and out on a commercial level, you know. So paying attention to how you build a game. You know, we've iterated over things again and again, and we've got some pieces that we've been trying out in some of our internal stuff where, you know, fast interconnects so that we can, you know, take, you know, play fields in and out easier and stuff. But also, like, making sure that this process of using our hardware, you may have different configurations of it. You might use a whole bunch of our smaller boards as you're kind of doodling this layout. And then when it's finally done, you might consolidate those into, instead of five of our smaller boards, into two of the larger ones. So that, you know, when you go to manufacturing or manufacturing, like in a small run, the process of actually putting it together is manageable. You know, we want to make something that's repeatable and consistent, but is also, you know, you don't have to have a huge complex assembly line or riggings and stuff to put these things together. We really want to make sure it's something that, you know, we can do. I mean, we can build a one-off, but if you had a bunch of parts laid out and some instructions that a few buddies can get together and build a line of games, just by making it simple.
We have 3.5 minutes left. Are there any internet questions? Because everyone else who's here with questions, we can take later. If not, what I'd like to do is just sort of talk about what happens next. First of all, Brian Cox has got a plane ride home. He's leaving in 2 minutes. His machine will be left behind. He's taking the computer that runs it, so I've got his code on my computer. So we're
testing that key feature that you can take the computer out and put in another computer, and it should run just as well.
Yeah, it's true. The only thing is I have to adjust the position of the display because there's the LCD display in the back, so I got to tweak the values there. So we'll take this back to the Fast Pinball booth, and then you can stop by and play. We'll be here, you know, this afternoon and all night. So in our last 2 minutes, though, I just want to do closing thoughts and just anything else that you guys would like to share. You get 30 seconds each.
I gotta say, like, our booth every year ends up looking like a workshop. You know, there's sawdust on the floor and wires all over the place. But I walked away for a little bit and came back the other night, and there's a crowd of people curious. Because a lot of times they don't get to see things opened up next to somebody who can describe what they're actually looking at. So it's really exciting for people to come and see, like, wow, here's guys like me building games, and I can learn about it. And it's enticing people. We had people come and tell us, I've been watching what you've been doing for years. This is great to see what people are actually doing with it when they get it, you know, get the hardware out in the wild. So that's very, you know, heartwarming, exciting.
Brian Cox.
Yeah, so my 30 seconds. I would really encourage pinball enthusiasts who maybe even have just a passing interest in building your own game. You know, now's the time. The barriers to entry have dropped very, very low, and there's a community out there already. And a cottage industry really built up to support this. And so I think, you know, really now is the time to, you know, become sort of that new pinball artist.
Dave Beecher, Fast Pinball.
For me, you know, what I really like is just all the community coming to me and presenting the problems to me that I can solve for them. You know, it's like that's what it's all about for me. So I love working with a group. You know, I need a servo controller. I need a stuff. I mean, this hardware is here because this is what people wanted and have asked for and all of that. So, I mean, to me, man, you got problems. You got questions. You got ideas. It's like, man, come talk to me.
Gabe Knuth, Mission Pinball.
I took the intro. You can take this one.
So like I said, you do not have to be a programmer to create pinball software. I've taken a lot of flack for that online. They say, oh, if you're not a programmer, the game's going to be boring. That's fine. Okay, make a boring game. I would rather have a boring game created by a non-programmer than no game. And if you want to be a programmer and you want to extend, you can do it. But it is possible to do today to build a pinball machine even if you're not a programmer, to create software even if you're not a programmer. Unrelated, I'll talk about RGB LEDs. This is the thing that people are almost caring about more than us. We went to AliExpress and bought some RGB LED matrixes and put them into a Demolition Man that's in the booth also. So it's kind of like a color DMD, but instead of an LCD, it's an actual LED matrix. It's super bright and kind of awesome. It's not a product we're selling. We bought these things online. We'll show you how to build it yourself. It's pretty cool. So come by and check that out.
That's what it was.
So, Aaron Davis, Fast Pinball, Brian Cox, Space 8, it's space-8 spelled out, is your website.
.com.
Space8.com. Dave Beach with Fast Pinball, Gabe Knuth, Mission Pinball. I'm Brian Madden with Mission Pinball. To all of you online watching, thank you so much. To all of you in the audience, thank you so much. Thank you for your time today.